The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Sin flies through a broken glass ceiling. Peter pops the cherry. Architecture. Julie gets into Medicare frauds. Brian shares his royal T-network, and Wynn has another vision and enters the sixth domain. This and lots more on this week's Cyber Show. Here we go!
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Fred here. Our next CEO's forum will be on March 7th at noon Pacific Time. Our Go to Angel live online remote forum for presenting to investors will be March 14th at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. Also on March 14th is our All.net members forum at 1 p.m. Pacific Time. We'll be discussing cybersecurity issues with some of the best folks in the world.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
Now on to our first presenting company.
This is a segment we call Sin in America.
Let's now just talk about one other thing. Give us a sense of what it's like to get into the detective world in this space, and your advice to people who listen to you and say, "Oh man, I got to do this." Besides, send me an email, right? Send Cynthia an email; she'll be happy to talk to you. But especially, you know, women that want to get into this field, what do they do? Who are your role models? And you know, the female role models.
I did just get a chance to honor one of them. Very excited about that. There are plenty of female detectives out there, traditional, you know, private investigators. I didn't break a glass ceiling. I walked through it, or I flew through it. But there's a gal out there. Her name is Kitty Haley. And she just received, I don't know, maybe her third Lifetime Achievement Award, because she is just this amazing, amazing human being. I swear, where in the world in Carmen Sandiego was characterized after her, because she's a stunning redhead. And she just celebrated, she's Forbes 50 over 50. Mm. So we never tell her age, but she's over 50. And she's been doing this for probably 40 years. She does.
She started when she was 8.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she's just like. She is a rock star.
She had to start when she was 12, because she's at least 52.
Right? There you go. At math, Fred, math. But sure enough, when I first came out and just on the detective side of the business, I kind of saw her in the distance and thought, wow, you know, who's that lady? And there was a room of people just surrounding her, like everybody wanted to talk to her. And she made sure to come over and say hello to me, because I was the new kid in the room. And she was polite and she was kind. And she was generous. Every single time I had an interaction with her, she would send a follow-up thank you note. I mean, there was a lot of personal vibe to it. It wasn't just like, here's an engagement, do a case, get a report, pay the bill. It was like, you felt like you were in a relationship. And I thought that was a really good touch point that's really missing in this industry.
In every industry.
Yeah. Customer service, personalization, care and concern. And I get called out for this, and I didn't even realize this, but I followed her leadership in this space. I'm like, well, if I actually show people that I actually care about them, this isn't just the work that I'm doing, even if I'm bringing in a big case for a big institute and, you know, we're talking dollars and we're talking cents and we're building it out. And, you know, I'm a captain sitting at the table and he's a captain sitting at the table. At some point, I'm going to look that person in the eye and say, like, I want you to know I'm doing this because I care about the end product. I care about what you need to get done. And this means something to me. And if I can't accomplish this, I am not going to pick this up. If I notice we start working it and we're not doing to the scale and the ability we should, we're going to stop and we're going to talk. And the client stops every time and are like, oh, that's refreshing. And it's, again, the librarian side of me comes in and says, this is how I want to care for you. And really shocking to me, because I always like to say I'm kind of brawny and tough, but I was with special forces guys 2 weeks ago, and they're a lot softer than you think. I mean, they're nicer. I shouldn't say soft. They're not soft at all.
They're nice people.
Yeah.
And it's not just part of the training, but it is, right? You cannot be successful. Ultimately, what they're doing is an influence operation.
Well, I learned that now. Yeah. Because I thought I was the persuader, and I'm sitting across, and the fellow looks at me right in the eye, and he goes, "You genuinely love people." And I'm like, "Oh, I'm a jaded old school detective." But he goes, "No, Sin, you actually care for people. You're doing this because this means something to you." And I was like,
"Don't tell anyone."
I know. I was like, "Oh, I'm not as tough as I thought I was." But it was actually very spiritual when he said it, because I thought, "Yeah, actually, I do." And I thought about the statement I have, the vision statement I have for my company is my number one concern is, or my value statement is, my employees. If they're not engaged, challenged, satisfied, then I'm not meeting their needs. The second is the client, because the client definitely is what puts us all here and calls me for that. And the third is the dogs. If the dogs aren't happy, nobody's happy.
Because they'll, you know, whatever on the floor too.
Yeah. So I thought that was really kind of a good thing. And that's why, like, when I'm working with, it could be special forces, it could be cops, it could be accountants. You have to come in and see it from their perspective so that you can meet their information needs, which is what we do. And leave, you know, everybody leaves satisfied. And I think that's real important. And I love what I do every day. I still love doing this work.
You know, what's the saying, right? If you love what you do, you never work a day in your life.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
But hopefully you still get paid.
Yeah. Well, now I'm at an age where it's like, you're paid well.
There you go. Cynthia, it's always a joy to talk to you. Thank you so much. And I'm going to stop the recording, and then we'll just chat for a minute afterwards.
And now a word from our sponsor.
On Tuesday, March 14th, go to Angel. Pitch your company to investors and get a listing in A2E's global directory, a pitch to our global investment community, a slot on the Cyber Show, and an investor follow-on call. To sign up, click on the link at thecybershow.co. To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. Snow in Los Angeles has helped create more than 5,000 startup companies. While the snow removal companies are mostly one-person shops that we expect to fail within a few days, the AI snow removal companies are expected to grow into multi-billion dollar enterprises to be purchased by Microsoft. We now return you to our regularly scheduled program.
Do you know someone who would like to be the CEO of an emerging cybersecurity company? This month, the machine learning-backed network scanner targeted at finding insecure paths is looking for a CEO. If you know someone who has the right stuff, or if you have the right stuff, get in touch with the CEOs for Startups program at Angel to Exit. Well, now, on to our next company. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Peter Neumann. His long career exemplifies a great deal of the time and effort and expertise involved in the development of the cyber world that we live in today.
Well, so that's another interesting question, what you defined as the term secure.
Yeah, well, secure means, or to me, it's trustworthiness.
Is it trustworthiness? How is reliability different than trustworthiness?
That is, well, trustworthiness is the overarching thing that includes security, reliability, availability, survivability, interoperability.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to the question of what is that security part? How are you going to define that? Because that's one of the problems we face still today in security is we don't have a good definition for the word.
That's true. But what I just said is not secure. If you can't trust the hardware, you can't trust anything.
Well, when you say that, you can't trust any hardware. It's never perfect.
That's true.
So you can't trust anything.
So we need.
But when you say trust, the term trust is also a meaningful word, right? Because what you can interpret trust, and many people do, as your willingness to suffer harm at the hand of another.
Yeah.
So when you say trustworthy, there's nothing that's perfectly trustworthy, right? I mean, eventually you're going to die, but, you know.
Well,
But it's measured in context.
Yeah, but it's right? Context. The context is it's trustworthy with respect to the requirements that you have established, and you are able to demonstrate that you have satisfied.
Absolutely. That specification problem we still haven't solved, because we don't even know how to specify things well enough across the full set of domains to understand what we're looking for.
And that gets us to the cherry architecture, where we've actually been able to prove properties about the instruction set architecture.
Prove some properties.
Yeah, critical security properties.
Well, I'm sorry, what are those critical security properties that you're proving?
Well, in a capability architecture, it's that the capability is non-forgeable. The access to anything is non-bypassable. There is no way of accessing anything without a capability. And the capabilities are monotonic in the sense that you can never increase the virtual memory size or the access controls.
Right, but that doesn't make the system secure in the context of solving a problem.
No.
It does provide you a basis, assuming that the hardware is perfectly reliable, because that could fail too. But again, assuming that the hardware works, then the capability system will provide those three particular features.
Yeah, but we have
proved with a high degree of certainty.
We have proved those three features for the Cherry ARM 64-bit computer.
But now the question is, how can you leverage those features to get all the other security features that we might eventually want?
Yep, exactly. Now we have to start. We're also adding compartmentalization, where we can break things down and have them in little pieces that interact in a very controlled way.
So temporal microzones is, I think, what you want.
Yeah.
So are you saying you can prove that you got effective temporal microzones?
Yeah, we're working on that.
Yeah, because once you can show that, then there's all sorts of stuff you can do. There are other problems, right? Because the way we want to use these systems are such that, you know, we want transitive trust for the most part. And that's a problem. And time transitivity of access is another, you know, whole set of challenges. Without getting into the details, because the poor people on our program are probably completely lost now, I want to move on to something else. Okay, so now we're starting to see, yet again, trying to get it perfection, and it's wherever you go, it's going to break down, because I got to tell you, that's my job, right, is how everything breaks and what we do about it.
Right, but yeah, I think Peter kind of misses the point here. I think what he was describing is dependability properties, security, reliability, safety, and those types of things. Trustworthiness is, in my opinion, is the evidence that you can supply that those dependability properties are supplied at the level that you market them as.
Yeah, if it's worthy of it, right?
Yeah, is it worthy of the designation, you know, of it being
the consequences that I'm willing to place upon it, right?
Yeah. And I very much disagree that we can trust in the hardware. Even the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, has funded a major program on split manufacturing, because for integrated circuits, because we don't have many trusted foundries, hardly any left in the you know, on the globe, and it's problematic. And by trusted foundry, I mean one where the customer knows that thing, what's actually how the integrated circuit
I'm going to shortcut you here, because trusted is the term of art. Trustworthy is not trusted, right? Trusted means they decided they would trust it. Worthy of trust is a different issue, and that can't be determined pre hoc. It can only be determined post hoc. If and after something goes wrong, then you look back and say, oh, well, it wasn't in fact worthy of the trust we placed in it.
Right. But the interesting thing about this DARPA program that I think is already wrapped up was that the performers, people conducting the research, were able to show that you can have untrusted hardware produced by untrusted foundries.
Untrustworthy hardware.
Yeah, exactly. But you can have a trusted part of the hardware, various layers of the one set of the layers of the integrated circuit,
And I can have a separation mechanism that puts a diode. You put a digital diode between two untrusted things. You can guarantee the information only flows one way.
Correct.
Which was proven in the 1980s when I did the research into digital diodes. You can develop a post set with that. All that's understood.
Yeah, it goes into also, you know, the fact that you want to protect against certain types of behaviors. So if
But hang on, there's all sorts of other layers here, right? Because you know, there's a whole area of, you know, signals processing, right? Mm-hmm. So you can produce waveforms, and the waveforms interact with systems in ways that cause those systems to not operate in the normal manner that they were designed to operate in. And the smaller the features, the less energy and power required, the easier it is to produce waveforms that cause them to misoperate. So once you start to get into the hardware reliability issue, trying to make it fault intolerant is enormously problematic. So let me give you an example of one of the approaches that we took. One of the approaches we took to this was to say, look, instead of trying to buy reliable stuff, we're going to go buy off-the-shelf crap. But what we're going to do is disassociate our purchase of that crap from who we are. So we're going to go to N different sources and just buy parts from each of them. So we don't know that any of them are reliable or trustworthy. What we know is, if we've done our counterintelligence well, that the person who's building those things doesn't know that it's us, that it's putting these different things together from these different places to compose the system we're making, which means that they can't systematically identify what we're doing and that they're and who they're coming after. So now, unless it works against everybody everywhere on a statistical basis, we can assure that we have a random selection of stuff instead of a directed attack against us. And now we can take other methods, right? So you can do things like looking, you know, taking micro pictures, micrographs, and so forth of components and making sure that the physical components are identical to the other things that you've seen. And you can also build redundant things where I use, you know, five or six different kinds of processors from different factories from different places and have them do redundant computations so that, again, systematically causing them to fail in a consistent manner becomes difficult.
John Knight and Nancy Levison, and I can't think of who the third author was, they published a seminal work where they showed that diversity, software diversity doesn't save the day. And I think it applies.
Well, this is hardware diversity, but
yeah,
right.
It doesn't matter. Yeah.
Well, but it does certain things, right? Mm-hmm. That is, the software diversity, if well done, right? Because when John Andreas did these experiments early on, what they found was that the faults from independently created software, there were common mode failures. Even if 50 different people wrote the software, they still had common mode failures.
Right? Yeah, that was the point I was trying to make.
People make the same mistakes, right? So, yeah, I mean, we do understand that. But the question is, what are you trying to counter, right?
Yeah.
And we're not trying to counter the random thing going wrong. We're trying to counter an intentional, systematic attack specifically focused at this target. And so that's something we can counter with those specific techniques. And part of the idea here is that given an understanding of the threat environment, giving an understanding of what we're trying to accomplish, if we can define the problem, we can find solutions. They may be expensive and time-consuming, but we can find these solutions. But there is no universal solution. There isn't even a universal problem. And so at the deepest issues, we expect too much of things that we can't even describe what we're trying to achieve. And this is the difference between what we can describe in policy at this philosophical level and what we can implement in technology, which has to be physical.
But I think we can. I mean, to some extent, if you keep your engineering solutions simple, I'll give you an example from the automotive world. I have a Ford Escape. My ABS sensors, two of them failed. And the car could still brake, right? So it just wasn't ABS and controlled braking, but it was designed. The car was designed.
It was fail-safed.
Well, it goes into a safe degraded modes of operation.
Fail-safe, yes.
And I have a user interface that tells me, "Hey, you got to check what this code means, and there's something wrong with your brakes."
So building fail safes into systems, into safety systems, is fundamental. I'll tell you, you know, the same thing is true when we talk about water systems, right? Attacks on water systems, which we did studies of in the late 90s as part of the President's Commission on Critical Infrastructure Protection. We looked at lots of water systems. And we got all these publications about cyber attacks on water systems. And I wrote this paper that is probably part of why I got fired from Sandia National Labs at some point. The paper said, gravity works. Water flows downhill. So, you know, all those attacks don't change the fact that water flows downhill. And so we can still move water from here to there, even if your cybernetic system, you know, if your control system is attacked. You send a human being out, they manually turn the valve and the water flows, right? The chemical processes still work.
Yeah.
You know, the solution to pollution is dilution is an old saying, and it's not true writ large because we are such large volume of people that we can destroy the oceans. Nevertheless, you know, you can only put so much LSD into a water system. It takes a particular volume of LSD to get up to the concentration where the drinkers of the water will notice it, right? And so we put these chemicals in, and they're big bags of chemicals that come in trucks, right? It's not something that's cheap or simple or easy to do. So you need this systems analysis. You need to understand the nature and the magnitude of the problem and not jump to these conclusions about some, you know, change a bit and all of a sudden the world ends. It doesn't. You know, there's this huge waterway in California and the water still flows downhill, right? It doesn't matter what you do with the control system. Now, we did find ways to induce control system failures that would physically disable portions of that water system for periods of time, as well as parts of the power grid. But even then, and when we went to the FERC at the big FERC meeting leading up to Y2K, I explained, you know, there's a plan. Here's the plan. You tell all of your wire personnel, you tell them which station to go to if the power goes out and they can't get in touch with anybody, so they each know where to go. When they go there, tell them to change it from automatic to on and stay there and watch. And son of a gun, if the power doesn't come back, it does. Well, it might not work today, but it certainly worked then. Because they're, you know, fail-safe, simple solutions, procedures, and systems that are not overly cyberized solve the vast majority of these problems. You don't get the efficiency, but you get the effectiveness. And that's what fail-safes are for on your brakes in your car. And when we forget that, when we design these systems so that's no longer true, then you become subject to cyber attack that can be, you know, the consequences can be potentially serious and you can't defeat them by, you know, flying the plane manually.
Right. And speaking of air avionics and vehicles and formal methods, I'm a proponent for moving away from those heavyweight types of techniques that Peter keeps referring to, you know, proving that the hardware from the very get-go is secure, safe, reliable, whatever. But using runtime, lightweight formal methods where they are actually, the formal methods are constantly running, even during the operation of the system, we call that runtime monitoring.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story. So, Julie, we're back. So you spent 21 years, investigating frauds in employee benefit programs. So then what happened? What did you do next?
I left the department. I retired and then I became a peace officer for the California Department of Managed Healthcare.
When you say you became a peace officer, that means you had a badge and a gun, right?
I had a badge, no gun. Because we weren't statutorily allowed to carry weapons. So actually that department was developed from the Department of Corporations. And so they actually, they kind of split off of that. And there were a number of legislative changes. And so the Department of Managed Healthcare became its own entity, separate and distinct from the Department of Corporations, which is now it's Department of Financial something or other now. It's gone through a number of name changes over the year.
So, all right, so a badge but no gun. So when you come up to somebody with a badge and show a badge, mm-hmm. do any of them decide that you're going to probably try and kill them or they're going to kill you, or do you get any violent situations or not?
No, well, all during the 10 years I worked there, no, I didn't have a problem like that. But the badge was extremely helpful in letting witnesses know that this was a serious matter. And so that they wouldn't just tell you to go pound sand and slam the door in your face. So it was, and also it helped that they realized that you were, you know, really from the agency as opposed to just a business card. So
you'd show the badge, say, hi, I'm Julie from, you know,
right,
the government, and I'm here to help you. Start answering my questions.
Something. Well, it just depends on what it was, but yeah, basically.
Now, this was all businesses, or were you also going to individual homes and other places?
Well, I was originally hired to operate their how do I explain it? Let's see, their Medicare Advantage solicitor misrepresentation program. Okay. So here's the thing. The Department of Insurance statutes do not permit or don't have any type of deception, any misrepresentation type of avenues on marketing so that you can go after an insurance agent for misrepresenting something to, you know, potential insured or to the insured. So, and insurance agents plus other individuals were selling or actively going out to elderly people who were eligible, primarily, of course, Medicare eligibles, and going around and really trying to browbeat them into signing up for Medicare Advantage plans, which is actually Medicare managed care as opposed to the traditional Medicare. So
hang on a second. So you're saying there was no rule against fraud? They could just lie about it, no problem?
Well, it's not that there wasn't a rule against it, but the criminal statutes in the insurance code deal with embezzlement and like workers' comp fraud. So those are kind of really, they're very specific. So you can charge other fraud charges, but for marketing purposes or going door to door to some elderly person's house, it was very difficult for the Department of Insurance to really stop someone and be more effective. So, and since we had them coming over selling our product and not their product, and we had an agreement with Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the, you know, company, or that company, the agency overseeing Medicare. That was what we were asked to do on essentially on behalf of the federal government. So,
all right. So during this time, was this all like walking around and interviewing people, or was there more computer related stuff?
Well, that's a really great question because I had some really horrible cases that I couldn't do anything with. So, and part of the problem was the computer. Like I'll give you this one example. It was, there was a really bad person that was probably part of an organized fraud ring who was able to access at night, created some sort of a program that automatically went to the Medicare.gov website where you could set up your own accounts. And so it actually somehow they got access to the patient information on one particular provider group. So, and they were actually automatically changing in the middle of the night people's coverage from Medicare.
No.
So it was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And these poor people didn't know it until they went to the doctors. And then the provider's office was having a terrible time with it. And so and then when I tried to, I actually did get some computer information to be able to go back to CMS. I had to go back to CMS and ask them, you know, we need to get this information on this IP, the IP address, at least of where this is coming from, how it's generating. And of course, they couldn't give me anything because it was a third party vendor they used. And it was completely worthless. So Medicare itself has a lot of problems like that, which are actually caused by the way they operate it.
So when you say CMS, what is CMS?
It's the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They are a division of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Got it. Okay. So they're outsourcing all this stuff to third parties.
Right.
So you have no idea and there's no process for investigating. There's no good audit trail of where it came from. So hunting them down is essentially infeasible without going through complex process of, it says multi-state, right? So, but I guess it's all federal jurisdiction. So you can go into the federal jurisdiction and get what the FBI to go and do searches of these intermediaries just to get the IP address that it came from without even, you know, getting back to the fraudster, right?
Yeah, that was of course, nobody wants those cases. Okay, they're busy doing other fraudulent cases with providers who are stealing larger sums of money. This was affecting people. This was, this kind of fraud really impacts elderly people because they have no idea that their health coverage has been changed. And then when they go back to their regular doctor, they can't get an appointment or they can't get treated. Okay. And, you know, and they have.
Under the rules for Medicare, you can't just change it back. You can only do things during the annual period and so forth. So is there a fraud response to that that allows them to fix the problem?
Well, it was always a challenge working with CMS. So they are supposed to have that, but at one point they used to work through another organization that was able to kind of work with the beneficiaries and take care of that issue, but they then took that authority away from that group. So
they deauthorized the people that could actually be helpful.
Yes, they did actually for that particular aspect, which was very helpful because you have this happening. This is like a very popular thing that people were doing for, like, when I first started at the Department of Managed Healthcare. I mean, at least I would say 2 or 3 years worth that this was, you know, people were getting flipped constantly. They would, you know, or either directly from their house where someone would sign them up and or they would actually upload false information on their computers that they carried with them, the agents, to put that person's information in and switch them so they could get a commission.
Okay, so they were basically stealing commissions from other parties by flipping them from one provider to another or one system to another where they could get their commissions, right?
It's really from one plan to another. So once you flip them from, you know, or if they're new, they get a better commission. So if you take them from a traditional Medicare, which is fee for service, to a Medicare managed care plan, then you get a higher commission right off the bat. And then what you do is you keep churning them after the commission time frame. So they were, you know, like, you know, in securities churning, you've got the same.
Oh, I got it. So there's a period of time where you get more commissions, then less, and then none. And when you hit none, you just flip them to the next thing, one after another, keep generating commissions.
Right.
It doesn't cost the patient anything more.
Well, it does hurt the patient because it, you know, the provider they're going to may or may not be contracted with the plan that they're flipped into. So sometimes people don't care, but then other times people, you know, were really harmed. So
yeah, you lose your doctor and oh, good gracious. Okay. So just a royal pain. The whole insurance company industry is sort of this way in a lot of ways, very exploitive in a lot of ways. We'll be telling more stories from CyberCops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co. Brian, the inventor, welcome back. So when you started doing inventions, you ended up getting on QVC and then got there again and again. And you got patents and you more inventions and you're trying to figure out whether to license them. At some point, things started to break through for you. Tell us about what changed it from, you know, well, I sold a couple thousand of this or I tried this into something where it was really a career.
The products that I, the inventions that I had that I ended up licensing, I let royalties come in through those, and ones that weren't necessarily the right time for a company to license, I ended up continuing on the path of just doing it myself and manufacturing it myself. And as I had some level of success of building them up, I had other people come to me and ask me to help them with their invention. So I started to get into the business of helping others and inspiring others that if I can do it, you can do it. I'm nothing special. And I just continued to try to put myself out there to say, I have the information. And as I kept going and learning everybody's challenges and successes, it turned me into somebody that is resourceful enough to help other people. And that's how I did it, Fred, with books and inventor clubs and radio shows and TV shows, on being a host of bringing in and helping to promote inventors and helping them and guiding them in the direction of finding success. But I could tell you, Fred, most of the time I help people to realize to stop and not work on their ideas. And it's not just based on how I feel or my emotion, but sometimes depending on the product and the person, it might not make sense to put something in to get very little return if that's what you're looking for. If you're looking to hang a patent on the wall, that's a different story. You know what I mean? Because that could make somebody feel good too. You might not need the money. But, you know, that's the reward that I get. Like I mentioned earlier, if somebody's using my product, I feel great knowing that people are using it for the reason I came up with it. And I'm still doing it. You know, I spend a lot of time helping other inventors and help them commercialize their inventions through licensing and manufacturing. But I do have some time to work on my own stuff too, which I'm really excited about.
Cool. This is the Cyber Show, so I don't want to completely ignore the cyber world. And everybody out there knows that cyber is anything with sensors, actuators, communications, and control. So did any of your inventions, you know, were they cyber in nature?
Well, they turned from an idea to a CAD file to a 3D print. And that is something that is continuing to evolve into amazing ways of taking an idea and just printing it right in front of you in a few hours. And hopefully it'll print just like a regular printer one day, much quicker. That's the frustration with it right now, is filling it with filament and different types of materials and watching it print for a while. And then, you know, hopefully it prints the right way, or then you have to do it again. So I still hire other people that have high quality machines to do my 3D printers. But I could tell you, Fred, that when I first started, it was hard to find somebody here in the US to make a 3D printer for me, instead of not necessarily being an industrial type of print. I think I went to Canada the first time and found somebody to make a 3D print for me. Now you can buy it and put it on your desk. Anybody can get a 3D printer.
So you say anybody. So you must have done a first one, right? You developed your first CAD file. How did you come to do that? Was it just something you read about and learned? How did you do it?
Yeah, well, I needed to figure out how certain products work and how they can work efficiently. And if they were getting produced, how much material they need. Is it too thick? Is it too thin? What's the resistance? What's the temperament of it? What material are you going to use? So all these things, I didn't really know. I was starting to learn about all these different types of rubbers and plastics. So I went to an engineer and I asked an engineer what I should do and how it should work and how these gears should make a twist and turn to be able to know that that's the way that it should be. And a few iterations later, I started to make my ideas happen.
Now you do them on your own with your own 3D printer, I guess, at home?
Nope. I still, you know what, I'll focus on working on my own inventions, helping other people with their inventions. And I have resources for anything that needs to get done. So I have experts in the steps that I need to commercialize my invention. So when I come up with an idea, I have somebody who does a patent search for me with a patentability opinion. I have engineer or an industrial designer, depending on how complex my idea is. I have a patent attorney, 3D printing prototypes, or a cut and sew manufacturer, somebody who's making wood or bending metal. And then it just continues to go on to protecting your idea, and then figuring out if it's something that you should license to earn royalties from or manufacture. And those are the decisions I need to make.
When you say I have, you don't own these. These aren't employees, right? You outsource it all, right?
I outsource them. Yep. It took some time.
So you have a network.
Yep.
You have a network you've developed over the years. And then with that network, you're now sharing that network with people that other people want to do inventions. Is that basically
Absolutely, Fred.
So your know-how plus your network gives them an opportunity they just otherwise couldn't get. All right, let's talk a little bit more about that next time. Now we start to get into just this whole different approach, the network approach to success. And I guess it's always been true, but historically, we think of this so-called old boys network, But right. The reality of today is it's the everybody network, right?
Well, the old boy network was the only one in town. It was slow and hard to crack, right? It was stagnant. You know, aside from good or bad or otherwise, it's just not very competitive and productive, right? You know, that's why we evolved around that. That's why open systems and open standards and also a democracy and freedom of speech and, you know, so forth instead of authoritarianism just works. Because it works faster. Because you can make a network, you can be Brian, and you can make that network on your own, achieve success, change the world in small or large ways, and you don't need to plug in the one and only game in town.
Yeah, but there's part two of it, and that is his willingness and ability to share that network. It's an incredible value to other people that he's able to share that network and that he brings that to other people. And I'll say, we talked to Kevin at length in previous discussions. And Kevin, you know, he went through his life sharing his network and introducing people. And to a large extent, that's what you do. It's this development of relationships over time and sharing of those relationships that brings value to other people. And I think it's just an evolution of mankind, of humankind.
Well, I do think it's Darwinian, right? You know, and I understand, you know, that people want to, you know, protect their network and stuff, but you know, I've got 20,000 LinkedIn connections and so forth. I dumped that entire database, you know, with Sybees looking at that because the names by themselves don't mean anything, right? You know, I take my network really seriously, right? And I'm not going to expose it to risk. At the same time, I'm not so afraid that someone's going to take it over, right? You know, you can know everybody I know and you can have the whole list of names. That's not going to do you a lot of good, right? It really is, you know, it's the functioning network. So opening that up and saying, this is of value to other people, right? It is. And I want to touch on, you know, again, this is the cyber show, right? And I love Brian's answer. I was thinking the same thing. He takes a computer and he represents some idea and it turns into a physical thing, right? That's the cyber part of it. And as a Star Trek kid, you know, anybody like me as a kid watching Star Trek in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s, and you see this physical thing, this person or something else, equipment turned into information and transported across space. You know, the information is there somewhere in the computers and it turns into a cup of hot tea. And we're fascinated right at this point right now where what is cyber? What is a physical thing? Collections of information.
So I appreciate that. But, you know, this sharing of the network, you know, the time right. and effort it takes to create that network and the willingness and ability to share it is part of the same thing we were talking about with Brian before. It's this level of self-confidence and self-trust that says that I'm okay with sharing people because it's my relationship that they trust, and his ability to build trust by giving. I think it's a fascinating component. And we live in this era where there are these incredibly wealthy people who are incredibly greedy, and they're making a fortune off of other people sharing with each other, right? But they're all keep it to myself, keep it to myself. And, you know, this is sort of the long old debate over, you know, sort of communism versus capitalism, if you will.
Well, I'm a believer. I think, you know, these cyclic and, you know, down cycles from your perspective, you know, the cause for up cycles, right? And, you know, I think the competitive advantages of open networks wins out, whether it's open technical networks. Look at it this way, right? You know, an OT, operational technology, critical infrastructure networks, a couple decades ago were so fragile or seen as so fragile. It's like, oh my God, we can't connect that to anything else. Anything connects to it, it's going to die. And we slowly moved over the decades through understanding there is no air gap. It needs to be connected. Today, you talk to the best OT people in the world, they'll say flat out, cloud. You have systems out in the world somewhere in this cloud thing that are, in fact, have to be directly to the programmable logic controller that's controlling that valve. So, but it's because the networks themselves are not so bloody fragile and we're not so afraid. That allows us to do the things technically that we can never do. You can't build a single closed national power structure network. That's not a thing.
No, it's not possible. But now this brings us to coopetition, right? So I'm thinking in terms of these large scale structures, like so you have capitalism and communism, which I don't view as political systems. I view them as financial systems. And I think what's emerging is a different financial system that's neither of those that works with democracy.
Well, right? What I like about the word capitalism is capital. What is that capital? It's the thoughts in your head, right? You know, it really is.
Capitalism is historically what the capital is that money. That's that investment money. And that's what's going away. That's what's transforming from money into ideas.
Right. That's my point. You know, I think the capital, you know, has been, again, we go through stages, right? You know, using chunks of gold and so forth to represent capital is, you know, again, gold isn't very interesting. Can't eat it. What is really interesting is, and always has been and always will continue to be, is the idea. That's the capital, right? And the network is the capital, right? You know, so it's the same model. You know, it's still, I love the personal responsibility aspects of capitalism and democracy and freedom and so forth. Freedom of speech, and it's being artful about it. And to say, yes, I protect my network of people or my physical network or whatever it is. However, you know, it is strong and stable enough. I'm confident enough how it works that I, in fact, connect it to everything because it makes it bigger.
I think we have a lot to learn about this control system, this cybernetic system that links into this whole concept of model-based situation anticipation and constraint. And I think it's embedded in everything we do, and that it's sort of the fundamental of risk and risk management that we don't yet understand. And I think that somehow we have to transform everything we think about in the cyber arena, and especially in the cybersecurity arena, to recognize this new structure and this new way of doing things. And I think we're nowhere near having it understood yet. And before you understand it, you really can't enact it. And I think that might be one of the reasons we're facing such difficulty in the cybersecurity arena.
Well, today I recorded the 40th episode of the Cyber Perspectives podcast with our friend, York Eschweiler. And we've talked transparency with 40 top minds. And, you know, in the context of this cyber software supply chain thing, and I don't know. I mean, this is to our point about Brian, right? We have a guest here, right? You know, I invent other things in my head. I like to test them out with a lot of other people. I think this basic idea we're talking about, that what we're driving towards is a more transparent world that allows us to have more resilient networks of people and computers that can, in fact, therefore, you know, more productively interconnect with each other. I think it's all related.
Well, but all that transparency, if you take it to excess, leads to vulnerability, maybe because we don't know how to do it yet.
Well, that's where the artfulness comes in. You know, and it's talked to the Walter Isaac folks today in the DLM context, the supply chain context. It's fascinating because the same conversation is going on in supply chain, have been going on in threat intel for years, decades. You know, does this mean I give away all of my IP to all my competitors? No, that would be silly. Does this mean I tell all the, you know, attackers how to leave me defenseless? No, that would be silly too. Now, that's off the table. Let's talk about what we're really sharing.
Right. And that's the thing that you've been doing for a long time, introducing this concept that a little bit of outbound sharing by many people in a large network has a tremendous effect. And you don't have to share everything. If you just share a little bit here and there, the aggregate of what everybody gets shared in from a small number of people sharing a small amount outbound is very useful for everybody.
And there are, you know, there's new and there's ancient. There are ways to do this. We all know these ways, right? These are human ways, right? You know, and we have information security terms from anonymity and whatnot, right? But there are ways to gather the right bits of information. We all do it all the time.
Trusted intermediaries is one of those concepts. Right. That's what the value of consultants are. It's not that they can listen well and tell you what you said. It's that they do this with enough different people and they're smart enough about it that they get a bigger picture. They see the elephant and they can help share the elephant with everybody instead of everybody only seeing one part of the picture.
Right.
And now a word from our sponsor.
On Tuesday, March 14th, go to Angel. Pitch your company to investors and get a listing in A2E's global directory, a pitch to our global investment community, a slot on the Cyber Show, and an investor follow-on call. To sign up, click on the link at thecybershow.co.
Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Every week, we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books.
The Cyber Show is brought to you by Space, the most commonly used character in the English language.
Now, on to our next service provider. We're talking to Wynn, who is perhaps the most influential person in the world when it comes to teaching children about how to be safe and ethical in the cyber world. Wynn, I'd love to talk to you for about 6 years, but we only get so much time on the radio. So what I wanted to ask you about now is, so what are you doing today? Obviously, you know, you're done with the, I'll call it, you know, the money-making part of your life. You're financially stable. You're, we'll call it semi-retired, like I call what I am, which is to say working almost the same number of hours, but not getting paid at all for most of it. But doing whatever you want to do. So what is it that has you passionate now in the cyber world?
I'm not going to go into a lot of the details. Back in InfoWar, information warfare, cyberware, and all that came to me in a vision, you know, taking a shower. And that was 85, 86, I don't know, something like that. And that generated, you know, 30 years of chaos and created the fourth domain of warfare before Space Force created the fifth domain of warfare. And so, in roughly February of March of this year, I had another vision, which has opened up quite clearly to me the sixth domain of warfare. And it absolutely knocked me over when I started, when the idea first hit. And then as I started poking through a few of the details and running a couple of the trusted friends, it was like, this is real. And so I am working on a new book about the sixth domain of warfare that apparently not many people are aware of, and going to start talking about it in public, pieces of it in December, and then I will be releasing the thesis to the Canadian government at a conference in February in Canada.
So, you know, this won't air until at least January. So if you want, you can mention what it is. Is it influence operations by any chance?
I'm not going to get, well, influence operations is part of absolutely everything, no matter where you are these days. You know, if you're on email, if you're watching the news, if you're reading the newspaper, it's all influence operations. But influence operations, yes, are a significant piece of the sixth domain of warfare. But I'm not going to allow you to suck me into giving you details yet.
Well, okay, that's fair enough. But I just a name for it. Can you just give me a name, or are we going to have to, what, re-record you later?
A name for what?
For the domain.
Oh, no, I am not going to do that yet. A couple of my patents are being modified to include this now. In fact, that's what I got to finish this week. It takes time-based security, analog security, and applies it to, I mean, we'll use the word influence. Okay, I'll go with that, in the sixth domain. And I look at the good, the bad, and the ugly, and the three classes. The classes, all of the aspects of the model match up very, very well to the original information warfare thesis. But this involves different technologies and different attack surfaces.
So let me ask you this. So one of the things that, you know, when I was young, I sort of thought that peace was a better approach to the world than war. And yet I've ended up spending a great deal of my life involved in, you know, attack and defense and conflict. And instead of in peace operations. And I'm sort of wondering, have you, you know, as you progress through your life, considered this notion of fighting for peace as opposed to, you know, continuing the conflict?
This was not a conscious decision, Fred. This was just an epiphany It was another one of those aha moments when a bunch of pieces of reading and studying, you know, all sorts of interdisciplinary things for years, it just hit. How did it hit? I don't know. But there's been a fair amount of self-doubt about it. But I understand your point, because back in the late 60s, you know, Vietnam and all that, and I was a total peacenik, absolutely. Oddly enough, I worked in the mid-70s for the, was it Navy or Army? I forget which. Through a subcontractor in New York, I was an audio-video guy, and we built all of the training materials and automation systems for training delivery to teach guys how to use weapon systems. And so that was a little bit of a moral dilemma back in those days as well. So, yeah, absolutely. When information warfare came out, I did my damnedest to try to keep it in the cyber domain and not let, especially in the early days, not allow too much of the physical and kinetic aspects of it to dominate, as information operations certainly can with the synergy and the hybridization of the two. I was trying to be pure just from my viewpoint, because everybody else was already gluing all this crap together. So I just tried to be pure from it. And then it wasn't only military because of the three classes. And it ended up being the corporate and the advertising, the disinformation, misinformation that affects everybody. So it's much more than militarization. It's about people. And that's what the sixth domain is about. And there's a couple of governments around the world that I'm already talking to about how to work out the problem.
All right. Well, I guess we're all going to have to wait until before this show airs to already know what you're going to be talking about during this show. So no worries. We can just put it into a time warp. It's no problem. So, Chris. So
cognitive security is, you know, the way I've been framing it for the last number of years, right? You know, and having, you know, worked influence campaigns, you know, with the Obama campaign, leading the rapid response team in 2008, looking at how that worked then and watching how things have played out since. Cambridge Analytica, you know, Peter Jukes, the founder and editor of Byline Times in London, was, you know, had a key hand in uncovering that. And talking with Peter through that period, you know, where are we right now? And, you know, I think it is an indicator that Wynn's excited, right? You know, I'm assuming this is what he's talking about, but it is. It's not just influence campaigns. It's a combination of what you're able to do with all of this. You know, the Gerasimov doctrine, you know, so-called Valery Gerasimov is credited with convincing Vladimir Putin to put billions of dollars in nation-state warfare resources into this. Not just, you know, I'm not just spamming you with bad information. I am systematically and programmatically messing with demographics mind. I wrote a little piece a year or two ago called Mental DOS, right? Mental Denial of Service. And just a short little thing, I try to frame this in cyber terms, right? You've got three groups, and I'm going to get my malware running on these three different groups of hosts, you know, and we'll call them pro, con, and other, right? And, you know, the pro group will respond to certain types of information I give them. The con group will respond to certain types. The other group, you know, may cut communications with the first two groups. So I'm lowering performance of the host and the combined network and the effectiveness of the whole thing. That's what we're doing with cyber means today, right? You know, propaganda, you know, for, you know, World War II buffs and so forth. As you mentioned this as well, you know, the kind of communications that were used to change the world. In living memory, still, you know, not that long ago, World War II, have been used historically, have entered a whole new realm with the kinds of tools we're talking about today. The combination of all of it put together, plus that ancient art, really is, you know, the sixth domain.
All right. Well, we'll see whether Wynn decides to call that the actual sixth domain or how he talks about it.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Do you know someone who would like to be the CEO of an emerging cybersecurity company? This month, the machine learning-backed network scanner targeted at finding insecure paths is looking for a CEO. If you know someone who has the right stuff, or if you have the right stuff, get in touch with the CEOs for Startups program at Angel to Exit.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Peter's CIA insider detection program gets canceled when they hire a Russian spy to replace the program. Julie only caught a $50 million fraud case. Brian gets intuitive with inventors, and Wynn calls out the idiot who claimed time travel at Black Hat. All this and a whole lot more. See you next week on The Cyber Show.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.